This is Bob Lang, oral historian with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is Wednesday, July 24th. This is the second session with Emeritus Professor Bernard Wentworth. Bernie, yesterday we covered quite a bit up to your appearance here at the university and some of your research. Before we go on today, I want to ask you if there are further reflections from yesterday, particularly memories of childhood, experiences while you were at college, in graduate school, things that were important in your life.
Yes, there are a couple things that I think I should mention. And when I was very young, probably in the first grade of school, I had to wait for the school bus. And the distance from my house to the road where the bus was probably, 400 yards or so. And in the wintertime, it was very, very cold. And it would be, maybe as much as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit at times.
Wow.
And when I went down to the bus, my dad would go with me and make me run around until the bus got there.
Oh, to keep you warm?
Yeah. And I thought a real sacrifice on his part. He was really busy, but he insisted I go to get the bus to go to school. Mm-hmm. And the other major thing in my childhood that I should have mentioned, that I was very ill when I was about 8 years old. And I don't know how you're going to edit this out, but it reflects the Wisconsin politics today a lot, because I had a condition called indolent fever. As a result of not drinking raw milk, unpasteurized, of cows that had brucellosis. And now there is a movement in Wisconsin
to bring raw milk back.
And I was in a coma for 9 days. And my mother had started to make decisions on my burial. And so forth. They thought I was going to die. And we had a country physician, which I look back on, and I think he was a genius. In the first place, to detect there was indolent fever. And secondly, to give me what little doctrine was available. And I came out of the coma, and hadn't been eating, and they didn't have the intravenous feeding, and so forth that day. And lost a lot of weight. My mother nursed me back to health. And that was in June, I believe, when I was about 8 years old.
Bernie, did you get indolent fever from milk that you drank from your farm?
Yes. We later, our cattle tested positive for brucellosis.
And brucellosis is what exactly?
It is a... Goodness, I think it's a viral. It's a bacterial disease.
Oh, I see.
I want to look this up. Yeah, bacterial disease. And it's in all the ruminants. Deer get it. Cattle. Horses do not. But all the ruminants, I think, are subject to brucellosis.
And it's not based on things that they eat. It's just bacteria that grow.
It's passed from animal to animal. Usually bulls tend to transmit it through inseminations.
And so was it hard to diagnose? You say
yes.
The physician was a genius.
Yeah, I think he was to pick this up. And about all he could do was to, hope that my immune system would take over and recover. He just tried to, nurse me back to health as much as he could. But once I went into coma, it was very, very difficult. And that would have been, 1942 or 3,
something like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Terrible time for your parents, too.
Yes. And I recall being rather upset that I wouldn't be well enough to go to school.
In the fall?
And I think we started school later than they do now. I think the farmers had some compensation for farm work.
I see.
I don't think we started till 11th or 15th of September. And I was well enough to go to school. But it left me with diabetes. And this is another thing that the physician diagnosed.
Wow.
Which at that day was, we didn't have insulin treatments and so forth. So my mother fed me a sugar-free diet, I think for about 3-4 years. I had the saccharin I had that time.
Uh-huh.
She'd make pies and stuff for my saccharin.
So was this, do you still have diabetes?
No.
Or did that go away?
It went away. It damaged my pancreas and the marvels of nature. I got recovery from it.
You must have a very strong constitution.
And but, you know, when I went in the military, consequently, they'd take me in twice a year, and they would do a glucose tolerance test on me, mm-hmm. which I got very, very sick of because I had that history of diabetes.
I see. So they were still testing you even after it had cleared up.
Yes.
Now, I'm curious. I didn't know that diabetes stopped spontaneously.
Apparently, there is history of this in youngsters. If there is something that compromises the pancreas, it's not totally destroyed. You know, I've looked at this a lot since.
I'm sure.
Couldn't figure out why. And this is what I find in the literature, that there is record of this.
So your pancreas repaired itself?
Yes.
Wow. The body is amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Bernie, on your illness, senior moment, I'm forgetting what I was going to ask you. So you were convalescing all that summer?
Essentially, yes. From probably mid-June to almost September. School start.
Time to go to school.
I lost a lot of weight. And I recall we had the same teacher again. And you didn't grow any this summer. She didn't know I'd been sick.
Well, she was observant, if nothing else. It really, I know what I wanted to ask you, Bernie. You made reference to Wisconsin politics. I'm assuming you must have a pretty strong reaction to the raw milk movement.
Oh, terrible.
Today.
I almost become political. It bothers me so much to hear this going on.
And what is the drive behind those farmers who want to sell raw milk?
I don't know. I can't, in my mind, figure this out. See, I have the same problem in academia. People, I teach a class part-time. They're opposed to vaccinations.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I just went and got my shingles vaccine because I had shingles once. I don't want anybody to ever get any. Why wouldn't people vaccinate? Yeah.
It is beyond me.
And this brucellosis thing, again, you're probably, I think it's for your information to edit it out, but it's maybe part of my being observant. I one time brought some property up on Lake Superior, Port Wing.
Uh-huh.
I used to go up there hunting.
Uh-huh.
And there was a public land, but it backed up to farmland. And just over the wall from the farmland, I found a lot of dead fetus, little calves that were partly grown.
Uh-huh.
That's a sign of brucellosis.
Ah.
And I reported it to the veterinarians locally. And I don't think the farmer ever knew why they come in and tested his cows.
Uh-huh.
But they did tell me afterwards they tested positive for brucellosis. And so it's still, you know, that was in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. Supposedly it was no longer a problem in Wisconsin.
What would be the attraction of raw milk? Is it considered back to nature?
Or, yeah, or I think that's the only thing I could see. It's certainly not any better.
Yeah. And so raw milk means it's not pasteurized even. Amazing. Well, just amazing. Well, I'm glad you survived. Well, we wouldn't be doing this interview.
I have a list of 9 lives, and I do have, I have 9 of them.
Yes, you mentioned that yesterday. Well, one was about the bullet that almost killed you. Bernie, yesterday you mentioned, in terms of other experiences, when you were at the University of Maine, you got commandeered to work on a forest fire or something.
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, there was a major fire on Mount Desert Island. Actually, it's probably only 40 feet from the mainland, this island off the coast of Maine. But it became a very prominent resort area for the most prominent people in the country who would buy property there.
I see.
Yeah, the carpenters and the Doolittles and so forth. Mm-hmm. And very, very, some of the most expensive property probably in the country at that time. And it was a forested island. And it goes up, this doesn't go up that high. Maybe its elevation and might be a quarter of a mile in elevation. If anybody has seen it, they know what I'm talking about. You can drive clear to the top now. They've got roads clear to the top of it. And it caught fire, and the whole island burned. And all the woodland on it and all the property on it, it burned right up to the mainland bridge.
Wow, and so all the resorts were burned?
All the resorts were burned. And, you know, after the fire, it was just a black rock up there in the sky. And now it's just a beautiful green forest. It's suddenly regenerating. But when I was there, they caught fire. They were looking for help to fight it. And they tried to save some of that property initially, but it eventually gave up. But they said that all male students at the university that were qualified to take physical education would go and fight fire.
And you had no choice?
No. And they had a bus, and they got on the bus and went. And being a dumb farm boy, I had on moccasins. And I was up there on the mountain fighting fire and had a, what they call an Indian pump on my back, a water pump on tank on the back of me, on my back, and the fire kind of wind shifted and come toward me, and I suppose it's still on the mountain at that time, back water tank, threw it off my shoulders and run. But with moccasins on, you really can't run well.
No.
And I was struggling, I was falling and everything. I don't know why I didn't have sneakers or something on.
Is this another one of the 9 lives?
The fire was right behind me.
Wow. So you can understand then how those 19 firefighters got caught.
Yeah. All it does is take a wind shift.
So you all did not put the fire out. It must have been just out by rain or something.
Well, it burned to the bridge and they got it stopped there, so it didn't go on the mainland. They just sort of let the bottom burn.
How long were you there fighting the fire?
Oh, I think it was, I would guess, after that experience, I probably could bust home that night. I think the whole thing, they gave up at that point.
I see.
I was there a very short time.
But enough to get another good story. Yeah. Bernie, any other important experiences from college or graduate school?
not the baseball experience was good for me. It gave me something besides academia.
In so high school and college?
Both, yes. In high school, I was probably considered one of the outstanding athletes in the school in baseball. I could play the game very well. Small school, we had 100 students in the school, maybe 130.
Oh, and won the entire high school?
Yeah, and we won the state championship in baseball.
Wow.
We had an outstanding pitcher, and I caught.
Yeah, you were backup catcher.
Well, I was catcher for high school.
Oh, you were catcher for high school.
Yes, and he was just outstanding.
The pitcher?
Yeah, he got recruited by the Braves at the time.
Oh.
And but a young farm boy, alcohol got the best of him. In fact, he was one of my best friends as a youngster. And he probably died at the age of 38 or so.
He got seduced by the high life of success. That's too bad.
He didn't have any, road smarts out of a rural country town.
Yeah.
But, we won that state championship game in 11 innings. He pitched all 11.
Wow.
He was good.
I guess so. Your dad must have been proud of your baseball career.
He would come to baseball games.
Would he?
He might come to graduation.
And he had played semi-pro?
Yes. Yes.
And for which team?
It was then the double A team if they had them. I don't know how they had them classified those days. But the lowest level of the Boston Braves.
Of the Braves. It must have been a sadness for you here at the university when the university dropped baseball.
If I could talk with the athletic director today, I'd...
You'd let him have it?
Yes.
I thought it was actually, Bernie, I'm not an athlete, but I thought to drop the most American of sports was a crime, really.
Yeah, every kid in Wisconsin, boy, seems like wants to play a little baseball.
Absolutely.
It's not an expensive sport.
No, I couldn't believe that dropping baseball would help balance the budget or whatever the rationale was.
Yeah. This is one thing I give credit for the University of Maine for doing with it. They still have an outstanding baseball program.
Do they?
Yeah. They have artificial turf and just the state-of-the-art in college baseball. And they go to the College World Series about every 4 or 5 years.
Really?
They're that good. Of course, they're always sending me letters and want money because
I'm an alumni. I was just going to say, do you get hit up for money for the baseball team?
Sure do.
At the University of Maine?
But they invite me back to the banquets and stuff.
Do you go?
I don't go, but at least I get an invitation.
Well, you should go. Get a standing ovation from your fellow athletes.
Oh, I wasn't that good an athlete. In
high school, it sounds like.
But to go from that level to the college, I was okay in college. I think I played every position on the college team. In fact, I pitched 2 innings. We were getting beat by the Quantico Marines. 21-0 was the final score.
Wow.
And I pitched the last 2 innings because we went through every pitcher we had. So they brought in the backup catcher to pitch. I could throw him across the plate and let him hit it.
Did you play baseball all 4 years at the university?
I don't think I played freshman year. Probably I was so involved with...
In your studies?
Yeah. because it's a spring sport, I may have possibly gone out and tried out in the spring of my freshman year, but I started playing my sophomore year.
Mm-hmm. Do you follow baseball to this day?
Yes, I'm very disappointed with the Brewers.
Very. I was always sort of a Cubs fan. But
I like the Cubs. They're my second choice. And I've always liked them. Even when I was in college, I liked the Cubs.
Yeah, what is it about the Cubs that attracts a loyal following?
Wrigley Field.
I know. My mother-in-law, when she was alive, watched every Cubs game on television. Didn't miss a game. Devoted fan. Did you continue playing baseball in any informal sense graduate school or later?
When I got into graduate school, I didn't play at all in Delaware. But when I got to Amherst, they recruited me very quickly for a softball team. And I played softball, broke my arm playing softball.
In graduate school?
Yeah.
Were you a catcher on the softball team?
Yes. Yeah. But I had a lot of fun playing it. And it really developed some community friendships there in the little town of Amherst, Mass.
Uh-huh.
Because of the softball connection.
Okay.
People that I wouldn't have otherwise ever met.
Did you play softball here at all?
No.
In Madison?
I followed, they still had baseball here when I came.
Yes.
And some of my friends still here in town. You may have heard the names, Andringa.
Oh, sure.
Robbie Andringa
is
playing. Bice. Red Bice.
I don't know.
He also went on and played pro hockey, but he was a good baseball player for the university. Then all of a sudden.
That was Pat Richter, wasn't it? Who dropped it?
They didn't have a nice diamond like the girls have got now, but I can remember going over here in the wind and rain watching the play.
You were a devoted fan.
Yes.
Anything else, Bernie, before we get to...
I can't think of anything. There's a lot of little things. I probably do not give my parents enough credit for providing the opportunities. They challenged... Well, I guess one of the things that probably made my laboratory university experience a success was... My dad taught me how to fix anything. There was nothing but what I could fix, And
so you had the
laboratory
mechanical
equipment.
Aptitude?
Yes, laboratory equipment that would break down, whether it was electrical or just plain mechanical, I usually could fix it. I could weld, I could braze, I could.
Oh.
And the fine things in the laboratory, I could. Solder. In fact, this one of my colleagues brought in last week, his keys to his car didn't work. And I took them apart and soldered the connection, and it opens the doors automatically. Those things are nothing. They're not even a challenge. But my dad taught me how to do this and insisted that I do it. We don't buy another one. We fix this one.
That's part of the main culture, isn't it?
I guess so, but I think my family was stronger than most. Because we did a lot of the neighbor's equipment and stuff, too.
I have the sense that your father was kind of a hard man. Is that true?
I think people would say that. And my brother makes this comment. Unfortunately, it might be the reason my brother never married. My dad would never give him time to develop personal contacts and connections.
So you boys, and particularly your older brother, were working all the time on the farm.
There was always something else that had to be done. Mm-hmm. When the cows were milked and the hay was in, there was a mowing machine that needed to be fixed before tomorrow. And somebody might be holding the lantern while you fixed it.
Wow. Did your mother do any work on the farm outside of the house?
Oh, yes. Like when I was in the barrel and they were in the fields, she would be there driving the tractor while my dad would be, you know, pitching hay on and loading the wagons and stuff like this. She would do the tractor driving.
Did you read much as a child?
No, not like my grandchildren do. But when I found something to read, I would read it. But we didn't have good library connections. Mm-hmm. And so it was just something that somebody might have given us a gift for Christmas or something, a book. And it didn't have much.
But my sense is that your mother probably in her own way felt pretty strongly about education.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Yep.
And probably would have wanted you to read.
Yep.
So you think of yourself as a product of your family?
Yes, I do.
That your parents had lasting influence.
Right.
So, Bernie, shall we turn to the university?
Sure.
Now, off record, I had said to you before we started talking about the department, I wanted to ask you how it was that the University of Wisconsin became, except for Cornell, the top-ranked university on poultry science.
About the time I considered going to graduate school, it was when we had a shift in American food consumption, and that poultry was no longer just a special Sunday or special event meal. It became something you could have once a week as a food. And the change in this was education of business and entrepreneurs in the art of poultry production. And these people were being educated by places like the University of Wisconsin. And the foundation was in nutrition, better feeds, that we could grow birds 12 months a year, and very quickly, and economically. And Wisconsin had the best nutritionists in the world.
And why did Wisconsin have the best?
Well, it goes back to a predecessor that you're going to get. Have you interviewed Milt Sunday?
I did interview him.
He'll talk about a professor, Halpin.
Halpin, yeah.
A Cornell product. But, you know, he was sort of a... He would be like the Leopold of ecology and wildlife. As to poultry, helping was to poultry. And the influence on Milt Sunday, Herb Bird, and these early nutritionists. Mm-hmm. And the biochemists that were associated in that era at the University of Wisconsin. They were not the biochemists that we realize today of DNA. They were the biochemists that were discovering that animals needed certain vitamins and certain minerals. So, and Wisconsin was a leader in this. Still, you know, dates back to the DeLuca era, vitamin D. You know, he has progressed into the medical forms of vitamin D, but we originally had to have vitamin D for chickens. We used to, didn't think we could get birds to grow and lay unless they could get out and get sunlight. You know, this made it very difficult to have poultry 12 months a year.
Yeah. Prompts me to ask you how it was that the University of Wisconsin, which is located in just sort of an average state, not a terribly wealthy state, sort of a mid-range population, how it was that the university was so superior in many areas. How was it that people like Halpin came here rather than, say, to Cornell or University of Georgia or wherever the other good poultry programs were?
I have an opinion, but I don't have an answer.
Okay.
Wisconsin had amongst its professorial staff and researchers an open door policy where they exchanged ideas and equipment. And it dates back to, I believe, one of the early deans at the graduate school. Like, all this property in the laboratories does not belong to the professor. It belongs to the graduate school. If he wanted to exercise his privilege, he could tell anybody to come and get it and use it. So I rarely know that that was ever implemented. I think I know of a couple occasions, but it mostly was, we knew it was, so if somebody wanted what we had and we were not using it, go ahead, take it, use it. And that's why we progressed, because we didn't stop at the boundary of poultry science and biochemistry. We just walked across the street and shared it.
So there
mentally we shared it, physically we shared.
So there was a pervasive ethic of sharing knowledge, that you were not encouraged to be in an ivory tower.
Right.
And you must have found that congenial.
Yes. This was, you know, immediately when I came here and met the faculty, you know, I was thrilled. Even in my short time as assistant professor at UMass, it was rather protective. My lab is my lab, my material is my material. And they would lock doors. Professors would go in and close the door. And
really?
It bothers me to this day to see a UW professor with his door closed.
Now, does that ethic of collaboration still exist on this campus?
I believe so. You know, I'm not actively working in this area, but I believe so because, you know, I still get email from somebody over in the Ensign and stuff. I hear you might have such and such a piece of equipment. Still have that piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. And so we're still sharing.
Was the cultivation of poultry a big industry in Wisconsin going way back, or is it a fairly new phenomena post-World War II?
It's even more recent than that. And poultry was not a big area of state agriculture until, I guess we'd say, quite recent. We had the turkey. That was the main part, the biggest area of Wisconsin agriculture, probably, when I came here. And there was a little bit of egg production, but essentially no meat production. And then in the 80s, the late 70s, the duck industry became a very prominent. Up until maybe 5 years ago, Wisconsin was the main duck producing state in the country.
Really?
The company has had property in Indiana and has moved the major part of their industry to Indiana, and they have expanded to California. It's the same company exists, but they've moved out. We probably shouldn't talk Wisconsin politics, but they blamed the environmental regulations in Wisconsin too stiff for
governing the disposition of duck waste, I suppose. Do you agree with that?
There is a give and take situation where industry could make corrections, but the environmentalists would have to give a little too. And I think they both would have prospered by coming to some kind of agreements.
Bernie, would you say that you were talking about cultural shifts in America, that it was more than the Sunday roast chicken dinner? Was industry the driving force behind that cultural shift, or was it responding to a cultural shift?
I think industry was. They made this a economical source of meat. You could afford to buy it.
Yeah. Chicken was much cheaper.
Cheaper than fish.
Yeah, and still is, I guess.
Yes.
I would say.
Yes.
And you, in the course of your career, had good relations with various industry representatives, didn't you?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and I was a good listener to them. And if I saw something where I felt I could help, I made a point to insert that.
Were you working with national industry leaders or mostly in Wisconsin?
Mostly in Wisconsin, but I did have national leaders too. Usually it might have even been a referral from the Wisconsin people. Said, we do this with Bernie, why don't you contact him?
So when you come to Wisconsin in 1969, Wisconsin is probably tops in the field?
In poultry education.
In poultry education. And continued there until the department was closed, I assume.
No, we didn't maintain it. Oh, nationally?
Yes.
Yes, I guess we would. But poultry nationally, educationally, slipped. You know.
What does that mean?
Well, I think probably 80% of all the states had a poultry department at one time. And they closed them one by one by one. And some things kind of make me sad at times. I was invited to Idaho to give a talk. The day I arrived there, they were demolishing the poultry department, tearing down all the buildings, all the poultry houses. And, you know, this was sort of typical. You know, you wouldn't think of Idaho, but there was a poultry department in Idaho. But all of a sudden, one day, it's is dust. And, you know, we have prominent poultry departments. Iowa used to be big. We still have animal science in Iowa with a little bit of poultry. And they have some poultry facilities left. Nebraska has a little bit of poultry facilities left. Michigan State does. And Purdue does. Illinois, I don't know if they have any physical facilities left. They have some, a couple poultry people and bench scientists. But every, you know, Maine had a poultry department. New Hampshire had one. Connecticut had one. Cornell was active, of course.
Yeah.
You go right across the country, they just wiped them out. I'm not quite sure. I don't quite sure. This is, I haven't understood our administration. We had an early dean here, Pound, understood poultry, the economics of poultry, the importance of it to culture.
Dean of Cal's?
Yes. But then after he left, it was a totally different understanding of why poultry was an important venture for the state of Wisconsin.
It's interesting to me that that happened. I would have thought there would have been agitation from the poultry producers in the state and the legislature.
Poultry is a massive product commodity and didn't have very many voices. They were three people representing the poultry industry of Wisconsin, dollar-wise. Whereas pigs and milk represented, I don't know at that time, how many dairy farmers they would have been producing milk, but it could be in thousands, okay? And even swine, it probably would have been, 400?
Really?
Poultry, three voices. They don't influence a dean very much.
So
I think I'm pretty much right on track on this.
Okay, well, it's important. I want to pursue this a little bit. So who was Pound? Did he come from Wisconsin? Was he a poultry man, or did he just...
He was not a poultry man. But he was a good listening dean. You know, I don't know where he came from. He was here when I arrived. He interviewed me. You know, my one trip here, they made a point for me to go up and meet Dean Pound.
Yeah.
He never heard of me before in my life, but he made me feel welcome.
And he sounds like if he were a good listener, he would be interested in what you had to say about your field.
Yes. I wished he was here when I was chair.
Maybe, Bernie, you could track for me how it was, before we get to your being a chair, how it was, what was the process that led to the final closing of the poultry science department here? From when Pound left, what are the key incidents?
I guess they were probably all relate to budget. You know, the use of the money available to the university, and of course it goes down to colleges, whether it was emphasis, whether it's engineering or liberal arts, and agriculture would come out rather low on the priorities in the budgeting. So anytime the College of Agriculture budget was cut, within the College of Agriculture, they'd have to look to where departments would, you know, be maintained at certain levels of economics. And then it would be under the political and commodity priorities who got the money.
Was poultry always vulnerable from the beginning?
Yes, I think it was vulnerable, at least in my time in the beginning, because of the, again, numbers of livelihoods represented.
Livelihoods meaning?
The business. You know, again, goes back to the three or four people.
So, did poultry science start losing positions?
Yes. Yes, as soon as you know that there was any budget adjustments, then somebody would retire and the position would not be filled.
When you came here, how big was the department?
It wasn't that big. Okay, we had Arrington, Skinner, Sunday, Bird. Then we had a products position that wasn't filled because of tenure. That's six. Did I mention McGibbon?
But yesterday you did.
Oh, so that makes six. Then we had a farm supervisor, which was a salaried position. It wasn't professorial, but it was. Yeah, that's right. It wasn't professorial. But the thing that tagged us with dollars more than anything else was the outlying farms. You had a chicken farm in Arlington, we had a turkey farm in Arlington, we had a poultry research facility in Madison, and they were all staffed. This poultry facility in Madison, when I came here, had five people working there. Now it has two. The Arlington farm, my turkey farm, I had three people working the turkey farm besides me. And they were paid salary positions. And the chicken farm next door in Arlington had even more. They had probably five people at the chicken farm in Arlington.
So those positions would be easy to cut, easy, relatively speaking, to say, well, Professor, we're going to have to take one of your turkeys. I see. At what point after you arrive here does it become clear to you that poultry science might be endangered here? Had you been here a decade yet?
No, I hadn't been here a decade. Because, you know, I could see, maybe it was selfish on my part, I could see my professional development more associated to the medical field. This is why I have my lab over on Charter Street, and my area of desiring to progress became more in the molecular biology, gene transfer, DNA. And there was no connection with my colleagues in the department on this.
I see. So you, in a way, struck out on your own. Yeah.
And you could say, well, that didn't do the poultry department any good, but I personally felt it did. And I'll agree, and I was right. Today, that's where the progress is in poultry, is in the things that I was attempting to start. DNA transfer and things like this.
Is that where the poultry faculty today are working?
Yes.
Is that what Mark Cook is?
Basically, yes. Mm. Yes. Definitely.
Yep. So, before we return to your being chair, what is the story of once the movement became clear about the closing of poultry science?
I think we've covered it already. It was progressive. We would close up position by position. Then we'd get to a certain segment of the program that we no longer had enough hands to operate as the way it used to be. So we'd even close that out.
Yeah.
You know, we would. At one time, I had 5,000 turkeys at Arlington, and it got down to the point that one man could take care of them. So I had just 1,800, and then that also changed the type of research I could do, because I didn't have enough numbers to be significant, statistically significant.
Yeah.
And it wasn't any sense to do it if I couldn't, accomplish a research that was good.
So.
And that was just mine, but the same thing was happening with chickens and nutrition and genetics.
So, when Roger Weiss comes in the mid-1990s, there is still a Department of Poultry Science,
there is.
But it's reduced from when you came. Was it clear that Weiss was brought in with, among other things, to close the department?
No, that was not clear to me. It was clear to make changes in the College of Agriculture, which probably included closing departments.
And did you have, you must have had many interactions with Dean Weiss?
Yes, I did. And many felt that I had better rapport with him than most. He would consult me on issues involving other departments. And although, we became victims, he also was looking at overall aspects of the college.
So how did it happen, Bernie? Did he contact you and say he wanted to talk to you about the department and closing it?
No, he never did do that. No. We just got notice. Well, I think it was at a college faculty meeting that he announced the department changes or something. We met up here in Ag Hall. That was the first knowledge that was going to come about.
And by closing the department, he wasn't eliminating faculty positions, was he? He was just not filling them as they became vacant?
Right.
So, at that time when that announcement was made, Arrington was here, you were here, Sunday was here, Skinner, and so you all continued with your...
Yeah, I think we even had the Genesis still. No, we didn't. He'd already passed away. McGivern had died.
Mm-hmm. And what was, when Wise made that announcement, What was the immediate and then long-range impact on you and the other faculty?
I think we made a shift in our research from field applied scientists to bench scientists. And people like Mark Cook had the background to deal with this better than others. You know, I think it found become rather difficult for maybe the Milt Sundy to do away with his field studies.
Oh, I see. It was easier for you to adjust to bench science, I am assuming.
I don't know if it was, but I made an effort to make it happen. Because I realized that I no longer could continue the operation of field science. It just took too many dollars for the people and the equipment, the feed and all these things. The budget for feeding 5,000 turkeys was horrendous as we look at it today.
Given the budget realities that the university was dealing with, do you think closing the department made sense logically for the dean? Or was it a mistake?
I think it was a mistake because he didn't look at our overall population and food requirements nationally and worldwide, that he did not see the role of poultry in this.
I'm assuming that at some point you made a clear position about what he was missing.
Yes.
And what kind of response, if any, did you get from him?
In particular, Weiss would remind me that dairy is very important. And we have a growing industry in cranberries. He'd always have another commodity in the state to him that was more important. Dairy was always first. And probably should have been. But, you know, I don't think it was global enough. He didn't recognize the role of poultry globally, not only nationally. You know, eggs is still, you know, I spent time in Africa, and eggs were like gold. You know, you could have eggs out here for 10 days on the equator and eat them. But if you killed a pig, it had to be consumed by night because there was no refrigeration. You know, eggs worldwide is still a golden type commodity.
In terms of addressing nutrition and food.
Yeah.
Much more important.
And it was safe. You know, an egg with a shell on it, you know, you could almost assume you're not going to get any bacterial infection from it.
So, now that I didn't know. So you could have a container of eggs that you picked on Monday and not refrigerated, and they'd still be good a week later?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's huge.
Oh, yes. And we're exporting eggs all over the world today. And our genetics, the big move in genetics is putting the proper bird on the Pacific Rim to lay a lot of eggs. That's where the our people that we're training in poultry are making their impact worldwide.
Because
they understand that. But back when we talked about closing departments, that was not realized. You know, we should have a department running this summer program, not being run by committee from all these states. I'm glad that we're doing this, but you know, I guess I was involved in setting this up, but departments should not have had required me to venture in this direction. Mm-hmm. The dean should have taken the bull by the horns and made the decision.
And since Wise left, there's been no effort to recreate the department?
No. I think a dean could make a worldly impact if they took this upon themselves to do it. And Wisconsin is an ideal setting to do it.
Yeah.
Because we have this basic training program where we're training all, you know, the poultry leaders in this country and much of the world now can track themselves to Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah.
Is this a good time to ask you about the summer program?
Probably.
How that came about and what your role was in that and what its impact has been?
Well, I guess it came about by, we had an annual poultry meeting in the Twin Cities, St. Paul.
National.
Yes, it was national, but they were concentrated the people in the Midwest would attend it because mm-hmm. they could drive to it and so forth. And it was, and I was there because of turkeys. And I would meet the turkey people of Western Minnesota, Dakotas, and we'd have Wisconsin. Arrington was responsible. We'd have a hospitality room, and just serve a few drinks and some smoked turkey and stuff.
Yeah.
We always got a lot of people to come, the producers. I remember we talked about, I don't know how you get this off the record, but Mike Wineland one night, a farmer in western Minnesota sold his farm to Wineland over a few drinks. He'd had a few minutes. Because I remember the next morning, the man's wife was trying to get this piece of paper from Wineland. But, you know, these farmers only came to the city once a year. And it gave us a chance to meet them. But the big producers would go, like Spabo, the egg producer. So he and I was talking, and he says, you know, what's happening in poultry? You know, we've got to do something. He said, we're not getting new knowledge because everything is closing up and no students. Well, I said, we're going to have to start something to get these students to stay together and form some system that we can educate them. And he said, well, let's meet. He set a date in Chicago that we would meet. So we went there and met. And we invited representatives from other states. Purdue, Michigan State, Nebraska. So these are some of the key voices that were involved. And some of the people are still active. Are very key voices in this. And industry. Land O'Lakes. A leader in Land O'Lakes is involved. You know, and so we met and discussed this, and then we had subsequent meetings and more as to what we were going to do.
And are you leading these discussions, Bernie?
I think it got turned over more to Mr. Spabo. He was more aggressive and outgoing, more vocal, mm-hmm. more emphatic than me. which was good. And I had no money.
Right.
University was giving no money to this program. And he was generating money from his own company and sort of shaming his colleagues into providing money too. Like Land O'Lakes, Duck Company, a broiler company. Well, you probably use Tyson. Not only Tyson, but Golden Plum. You've probably brought chicken from
Golden Plum.
Golden Plum. They're a big, huge company. You know, they're producing millions of pounds of meat a week. And he convinced these people to get involved with this, along with him, to create this. But it was up to me to find a location to do this, where we could teach, and a university that would give them university credit for it. And this is not easy to convince that we can transfer credit from University of Wisconsin, Purdue, and have equal meaning. So this took a lot of correspondence in the meetings, some road trips, just driving to Nebraska, to Missouri. This was deflating. I went through Iowa, met with the dean and the people there. Well, it sounds okay, but we're not interested in participating. I drive on to Nebraska. I meet somebody there, a woman by now is chair of poultry department in Mississippi. She was in favor of it. She thought it was a good idea. She's been a great participant of Mary Beck.
Mary Beck?
Yeah, Dr. Mary Beck. And she was, a physiologist at the time. And then I think she knew me and trusted me. Maybe that's why she was in favor of it. And then our former dean was lukewarm on it.
Which dean is this?
After Weiss. Sorry about my age. But, he came here. He was there, and he was the chair of the animal sciences. They'd already merged. Poultry was already part of animal science in Nebraska. That's terrible. Because he and I have worked nationally a lot. He wouldn't forgive me for this.
I won't tell.
Look, it'll come up. But anyway, I went on to Missouri. They would have no part of it. They said they had a white paper with Arkansas. And they were going to deal with Arkansas. And we continued working and working and working. And then at that time, we had an academic dean here, which was very, very helpful. How come my name's?
Richard Barrows?
Yes. Oh, that's who it was. In fact, he made the road trip to me as far as Iowa. For some reason, he had to come back to Wisconsin. And I went on, but we rode together to Iowa. But very, very helpful. And believed in it. Believed in the program. So we had an academic dean support from Wisconsin. Definitely. And he transferred his feelings to the dean very emphatically.
Of the college.
Yeah.
Did this have to go up to Bascom for approval,
yes,
too?
Oh, yes. And this bothers me. I shouldn't do this, maybe, but I'm sure you edit what you put down, but we were required to show on paper that we met enough hours in a day so that in a 2-week period we could cover the requirements for a semester. So a semester requires like a 3-credit course to have meet 3 times a week for 50 minutes. So we had to squeeze this into a 2-week period. And very rigorously we did this. Sometimes we had to start the class at 7:45 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And all these classes here in this summer program had labs. So we had to have a lab in the afternoon. And labs only count half as much as a lecture as far as university time and instruction. So we had to make sure the labs were long enough so that the half time would equal out to like we'd be in a semester. See, a 3-credit course in a semester with a lab probably had a lab on Tuesday, Thursday, as well as the Monday, Wednesday, Friday lecture. So I squeezed this all in. I put it all on paper, got it approved with the university, the registrar's office, and so forth. We did it. Now they don't. Our summer program is summer. They would start teaching at 9, let them out at 11:30. Labs would get over at 2:30. They're not following the rules that the university
set up.
Don't publish this. No. But I'm very disappointed that our Wisconsin group has let this happen. Because in recruiting our original faculty, it was hard to get faculty to come to teach as many hours in a day. You know, you'd go on and lecture on maybe you were lecturing on female reproduction. You had 4 or 5 hour lecture in the morning you had to be prepared to give. We give them every 50 minutes they got a break. But just like you would in a semester.
Bernie, when was this instituted? When did it first start, actually?
It was 19 years ago. It would be, what, 2004? Is that right?
19 years ago?
Yeah.
That would be 93.
Okay.
1993. And how long did it take you to get to that point of approval? Had you worked on it for several years?
No. Once I get things in motion, I was able to do it in a year. Again, to some of my other university contacts, you know, was on committees, the registration records committee. I knew some of these people personally.
Yeah.
Was able to go and sit in their office and negotiate this.
And did you teach in the summer?
Yes. I was probably one of the primary teachers. Definitely. I was in charge of teaching physiology probably for 3-4 years.
Oh, I see.
Then my wife was on the faculty of that too.
Uh-huh.
She taught. Another key professor was from Ohio State. A guy by the name of Bacon.
And how long, so if I came in the program, it goes on for 2 weeks?
6 weeks.
It goes on for 6 weeks.
But you only have one course for 2 weeks.
One course.
After 2 weeks, you went and took a second course. You took 3 courses a summer. So you got 9 credits if you went through the summer.
And then you got a credit that would transfer?
And we had to make sure we graded the same. An AB is different at Purdue than it is at Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You transfer an AB to Purdue, and they get a B. So we had to make sure that we didn't give ABs and so forth. It was either an A or a B. We had to make all these arrangements between these schools so the credits would transfer legitimately. We didn't want a student that got an AB end up with a B back to his institution. So we had to decide right up front. He's either an A or B, you know, make it really realistic and fair.
Is this the only such program in the United States?
Yes. The swine industry has made an effort to copy it. They've had their meetings. They've got their industrial people together. But it has failed to develop.
What do you think was the essential ingredient that produced success for your program?
The need for professional knowledge.
And that was driven by industry?
Yes.
And industry is still supporting the program, I take it, by making gifts to the UW Foundation or to the university directly?
No, we have the consortium, we call it, the summer program consortium. We have a full-time employee, a woman in St. Paul, that is in charge of this, and the money all goes through her office, and to the students, they come here in the summer, free housing, free tuition. Lou Arrington provides them a lot of meals, gratis, and she gets money from Golden Plump, Sparrow, Maple Leaf Duck, big females, Purina, you name it, anything that's sort of associated with poultry. Like the big egg producers and even companies out of the area help us out. Even a company in Maryland may be donating money to this program. Hmm.
And how do students get into it? They have to apply.
They had 100 applications this year, and we took 30. So this is one thing that's made us probably very successful. We get very bright individuals.
Mm-hmm. Are you on the student selection committee?
Used to be. Once I retired, once I stopped teaching in the program, they've sort of forgot about me, which is probably good. I think for a while they felt I had too big an influence.
Oh. Well, you are the founder.
Well, that's, but that, you need to go.
I know. What kind of people apply?
Well,
where do the students come from?
We have to be careful. They want to be veterinarians. So we have to make a judgment on, do you want to be a poultry veterinarian? Or do you just want to be a dog cat veterinarian? See, Florida's part of this program now. Because Florida can close their poultry department.
Oh.
And they begged to come into this consortium. And we accepted them. They sent up a professor every year. The Florida State University sends up money, goes to St. Paul to help budget, and they send students every year. But it seemed like all the students for a while we were getting from Florida wanted to be a dog veterinarian. So we had to be careful about when recruiting the students what their interests were besides their academic qualifications.
Bernie, if I applied and were accepted, do I just come for one summer, or do I want to come for two summers?
We urge them to come for two, but we do accept some for one. And now we're accepting students that are not being funded. We had a girl come this year from Cornell. She was an undergraduate at Cornell, paying her own way, paying her housing, paying her tuition. But we're accepting. And she wanted one year.
Oh, I see. And
she wanted my cook's course, is what she wanted.
Oh, really? So Mark teaches.
Yes.
In it.
He's a good teacher. This is it. The program is so good. We have the best faculty in the world. There's no poultry faculty in the world better than we have in the summer program.
Because you get the best from the country, right?
Yes.
Who else on the faculty here teaches in it?
Ron Keane, who's an extension man downstairs. Mark Cook. Mark Barris. And he was something we probably should. Can we keep some of this off the record?
Yes. What you should know is that you can restrict access to your interview for as long as you wish. So you can say, if you don't want anybody to listen to it until after your death or 20 years from now, you can so indicate.
Well, this sort of came about. They convinced me of budget problems in the college, in the department. I was a senior faculty member, probably the highest paid faculty member, this chair, and been chair. They said, Bernie, you're at a retirement age. Why don't you retire? We'll hire a physiologist as your replacement. Because I said, I want to see this program continue, and I'm a key component of the physiology. Well, we'll hire a physiologist to replace you. So I retired. You know, I think I might be still drawing salary today if I hadn't agreed to that. But I agreed to it. And they went out, searched the street. They hired an ornithologist who's not really a poultry person. His office is down the hall here, Mark Barris. Between you and I, our physiology teaching in this consortium is very poor.
Really? Oh, that has to be a sadness for you.
It's very, very sad. I should have stayed, made sure that we had faculty that teach physiology.
So why did you resign? Because you were...
No, because I was promised that we'd hire somebody, even a reproductive physiologist, they said they would hire, if I would resign.
But they didn't keep their word.
Oh. This is one of my replacement once we merged in the animal science chair.
And when was that retirement?
2005.
That's too bad. Really too bad. Life in the university can be brutal, can't it?
Yes.
Where do the graduates from this program go usually?
Well, one of the things with this consortium, they're offered also this lady in St. Paul. She deals with all these companies and gets internships for them in the summer. After their 6 weeks is done, they tend to go to one of these companies and they pay them above minimum wage for the rest of the summer. So if you come here for the summer, you may get sent the Golden Plump until you go back to school in the fall and get paid for being there. Usually Golden Plump, or most of these companies, provide them housing. I got a contract with a hotel. Well, you stay in the hotel. Well, I got a vacant house on such and such a farm. Why don't you stay at that house the rest of the summer? So the students, whatever they get, it's usually keep. You don't have to. You usually get food and everything else. So many of these students, after they go for the internship, if the company likes them, they'll give them an offer right there. You know, they may be just a junior. You're doing a good job. Would you like to come back again next summer for another internship and we'll consider you for employment? We've had a lot of them go through like this.
Wow.
You know, like the hatchery manager. Now, the Golden Plump hatching, you know, 2 million chicks a week. He goes through the program, goes there for an internship. they hire him. The same way with Roseca in Indiana, egg producing company. A student goes there for an internship, Roseca ends up hiring them.
I think you said yesterday the creation and operation of this program, you consider your peak contribution.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And why do you say that? I ask you because some of your research seems quite significant.
Yeah. Well, this program impacts the total industry. It gives brain power in the industry that they can more than overcompete the other meat-producing industries of our country. We can outperform the swine. We can make an impact on dairy. You know, even if we compare the coursework in dairy and around the country, the rigors of it does not compare with what we teach here in poultry.
Really?
Like, and overall, and you know, the faculty is so good in this program that there's very few other animal industries that can compete with this rigor of knowledge. It's a good program.
I commend you for it.
Well,
it's a real contribution.
Yeah. And it's the overall assets we have. Everything from, you know, one of the courses we teach here is what they call product technology. You know, now you can buy on the market duck bacon. They're making bacon, artificial flavor, tastes like bacon, but it's made out of duck meat. It's pressed to look like bacon. You know, this is one of our former students.
Really?
You know, and the good avian veterinarians, since they come through this program. You know, they took this program and went on to vet school.
And the students who come are all undergraduates?
You know, we've had, I think, a grad student come back from Nebraska. Yeah, I'm sure we did. She may have gone just the second summer or something.
Mm-hmm.
The lives of these students, a lot of them are, you know, my original, when I was doing a lot of teaching originally, I've tracked them better, but it's interesting how they end up. She went on and got her PhD after going through this program, and I just got word here last year that she's married a professional football player. She was a black girl. She went on and worked for Tyson Food in Arkansas and got a PhD at the University of Arkansas. Still working at Tyson's poultry, although she's married to a pro football player. It was a friend she met as an undergraduate in Nebraska. We've had several marriages from students meeting in the program. There's a couple up here working in a hatchery field. He now is a paramedic in the town. You know, he was from a turkey farm out here in Wisconsin, and she came here from North Dakota. But they met here.
Do you get many women, or is it mostly men?
You say 50%.
And now, Bernie, as I think about what you said about the closing of poultry science departments across the country, I take it there's still a large population of interested students in poultry science.
Yes. They recognize the economics of it, the good jobs after graduation in agriculture. Probably the best paying jobs are in poultry.
And that's because poultry is now so popular as a food?
Yeah. And they have their companies that are in the red. They're not losing money. They're not, they have some extra money that they can afford to give people promotions and things like this. You know, I just can't get over when these students graduate from here in 4 or 5 years, they're drawing $100,000 salary, and then
amazing.
And some of them are up in $200,000 or $300,000 now. And I just wonder why I ever became a professor.
Well, I think there are many of us who are glad you did. Bernie, we're continuing on the summer program, and I've asked you about other issues that are of concern to you.
I am concerned about the continuation of the program at Wisconsin in particular, because I do not feel that we have any faculty member that has this as a primary agenda in their employment. This is all sort of a secondary issue that they cope with in their employment.
That they try and fit in, that it is not a priority. Could that be fixed? Would it take the addition of another faculty position?
I think if they were to fill a faculty position, that they ought to look at the credentials and objectives of the individual to see if it fit in.
Bernie, are there still good candidates out there for faculty positions in poultry science?
Oh, yes. Some of them that have gone through this program. I just had a correspondence a short time ago. A girl went from Ohio State, and she got her degree here for 6 weeks, and then got a PhD at Auburn. We're looking for employment. She would, I think, be a prime candidate.
How many vacant positions are there now in poultry science?
You know, I don't know, but I know they keep track of the students that go through the program. And the last time I talked with them on the telephone, that, you know, over the years, 19 years, a lot of people have gone through the program. They only had a handful of people that were looking for employment in poultry. And they send out a notice when somebody has gone through the program and gets a job. They usually let us know where they've gone. And it's amazing that, I don't know very many that's been out more than 1 or 2 years.
And how many faculty are there now who deal with matters of poultry? Mark Cook and Mark Barris?
Yeah, and Ron Keane.
So
Mark Richards in product technology. He's across the street and over in muscle biology.
I see.
He's a very, very good muscle biology professor, good products person. And he gets together nationally recognized faculty every year for a course.
Really?
In product technology. He has been sort of the person that I have talked to you about as a leader in the program. He's the one, if any budget comes down to individual Wisconsin, from St. Paul to individual faculty members, and he sort of helps negotiate that and distribute it. And so he's sort of been a leader, but it's not with great effort. He's sort of doing what he's assigned to do.
Oh, I see. He doesn't wake up on Monday morning chomping at the bit to get over here. What do you see over the next couple of decades as the future of poultry science here at the university? Will there continue to be faculty like you?
You know, I think they will be. I think there's going to be a situation where a dean and others in administration is going to look at the state, national, and global issues and see that we need to keep this as a important issue in agriculture education.
I would think so. I was just curious. You're in it, so you would understand that.
Yeah, I believe they will. You know, and I hear about the issues of the day, and, you know, they can't meet the demand for 4th of July and drumsticks. You know, you know, it just, there's nothing in the freezer anywhere waiting to be distributed. It's coming right off the line and can't meet the demand of the day.
Interesting.
It's a big, big industry.
Much bigger than I probably have any sense of. And the egg industry, is that growing as well?
Steady. And we had a decline one time when there was a lot of bad publicity about the excess cholesterol in the egg. And some of this data had been shown to be incorrect in the first place. But again, it's a product that's so versatile, it's going to be used. I don't think that most of us everyday people can realize how much of it's in our prepared foods. Mm-hmm. If you buy a cake mix, something like this, you've got eggs in so many products.
Yeah.
Whether you're having mayonnaise or what have you. This is besides the daily hard shell egg that's used. It's a mainstay in the restaurant and diner industry, especially in before noon foods.
Bernie, that makes me want to ask you, it's sort of, what about all this organic chicken and organic food? Is there any difference between chicken that is raised organically, whatever that means, and chicken that comes from Golden Plump or Tyson or whatnot?
I'm no authority on this, but probably from the wholesomeness, the commercial non-organic product is better for health standards and so forth. But for your and my taste, maybe we like a firmer meat. The organically grown bird may be slower growth, may have a more firm muscle. Maybe you like that better. But the nutritional value of it, or the digestibility of it, may not be as good as the commercially grown non-organic product.
Well, you know, these days there are huge bins of organic chicken and commercially prepared. I'm never quite sure where to go, but I love to eat chicken.
The price differential you're paying is for your desire, not probably in the quality of the product.
Okay, I'm glad to know that from the horse's mouth. Bernie, can we talk now about your service as chair of the department? And I want to understand what the issues were. You were chair for quite a while. For 11 years, 1985 to 1996.
Wow, I didn't see that.
How did you get stuck being chair for so long?
Nobody else wanted it. I think we voted every year amongst the faculty, and I definitely didn't vote for myself, so I would guess the rest of the faculty didn't want it.
And what were the big issues you had to deal with as chair?
Again, financial, and deciding on what positions we would eliminate, and things like that. I never had any problems with the academic or anything. The professors all were doing an excellent job teaching. They were getting good student ratings. I had no problems there. I don't know whether we filled any positions while I was... Yeah, we filled a geneticist. And I think we, you know, had good faculty cooperation in selecting an individual for faculty. And he was a young man out of the University of Minnesota, well-trained.
As chair, did that take too much of your time? Did it take a lot away from your research?
Yes, it did. Because as chair, we had chair meetings in both college and other chair responsibilities in the university environment, and just meeting these. And you would be on search and screen committees of other departments. Mm-hmm. As a chair, you would get invited to participate in it.
And did you like doing that? Were you interested in who else was being considered for positions?
Yes, yes. I was particularly interested if they were, it was at that time, animal science was hiring, and I was interested in who they were getting in biochemistry. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it's very obvious in here. I don't know if I was chair then, was I? I was heavily involved with the creation of the vet school. I was one of the faculty members that hired the first faculty for the vet school.
So you were a staunch supporter of the creation of the vet school.
I worked with their first dean, Barney Easterday, in selection of the first faculty. Mm-hmm. Some of them are still there.
Really? And what was your rationale for supporting the vet school? I remember it was controversial, wasn't it?
Yes, it was controversial. My reluctance for being maybe mildly opposed has proven me totally wrong. I just didn't think that they would have enough inpatient clientele bringing patients into the facility to justify it. This vet school services Northern Illinois, Iowa, some of Michigan, and patients coming into the clinic. I didn't anticipate that at all.
And generally, are they able, the graduates able to find positions afterward?
Yes. Yes. They're trained well. I don't know how they rank nationally, but they're trained very well. And they have a good graduate program, too. When they hire veterinarians for teaching, they're looked at as being not only teachers, but researchers. They have research appointments as well as a teaching clinical appointment.
Is there a poultry track in the vet school?
No, unfortunately, there isn't. And this is where some of our graduates that go here to vet school, they'll come back to our program and say, I wouldn't know anything about poultry diseases unless I had taken Mark Cook's course, because they didn't give it to us in the vet school.
Lots of change, huh?
Yes.
Any controversies that should be noted during your time as chair that contribute to the history of the university?
No. We had some issues on facilities. We built a new chicken facility in Arlington. It's very difficult to get this approved through the college for their programming money for construction to the university's environment. It has to be prioritized. So that was almost a fight from the start of my chair until it got to be completed, was to get this priority, keep it up so it would get recognized. And then close the department, feel bad that we built these new facilities. They still exist.
Where is Arlington?
Oh, it's... about 5 miles... northwest of DeForest.
Oh, okay.
Probably the most beautiful farmland in the world. It's used to be prairie. They talk about some of the topsoil layers 12 feet deep.
Really?
I believe the record corn production bushel per acre is still world record, has still been set there. You know, it's not a big area, but what there is of it, they sold the area out here by Hilldale, which used to be the university farm, and then purchased that Arlington. It was a good swap in land quality. But unfortunately, it's a little bit too far away.
Yeah.
Like when I had turkeys up there, some weeks I was going up there daily. And always once a week. And that was one of the problems of being chair, that I had to, you know, keep my research going at the turkey farm.
And now, I've forgotten what you said. Is there any turkey work going on now?
None. Even nationally, it's not a high priority, because the egg and broiler industry has become so much more gigantic in comparison to turkey. The University of Minnesota does a little bit. And one of my postdocs at Proudman in Agriculture Research Services used to do some. But when he retired, that program phased out. Little bit in Arkansas, but not much. Arkansas is not a turkey state.
No. Can we switch now to your experience with the university and university service?
Sure.
You've been on a lot of university committees.
Yeah, and I'll admit right up front that I was not aggressive. I probably learned more from it than I contributed. I believe I was a very fair individual when decisions were made, I think I facilitated making the correct decisions. And I've served on a lot of these committees. And I think maybe I mentioned that this divisional committee that's involved with tenured faculty was the one that was the most trying mentally for me. I found it very difficult to make decisions to judge others not capable of continuing their programs at the university.
These divisional committees were committees of the graduate school, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So if you were on the science divisional committee, I assume.
Yes.
And so that would cover all the colleges, not just Cal's, but letters in science too?
Yes, if it was zoology, yes. Yeah.
Were you ever chair of that committee?
No. I think I was sort of selected to be the chair and I declined it. I think this is when I was also chair in the department, and I just didn't want to have that rather responsibility.
As you think back on your work on the divisional committee, do you think generally the decisions that were made were good?
Yes. Yes, and I don't think the public or the overall university recognizes the contribution the people that were selected to this committee has made to the university. I can throw out a name that everybody's heard about. He had a tremendous impact on I think he was on both my terms. Paul Carbone.
Oh, yes.
His contribution to medical science. His contribution to that committee was just tremendous.
And when you say contribution, you mean their assessment of the candidate?
Yeah, and breaking in new members of the committee and what they should be looking at and how to judge fakes from real and things like this.
Generally, did you think the tenure process was fair?
Yes, I do. I think they were very rigorously evaluated. It wasn't just a passive approach to it. It was very rigorous consideration. It wasn't just something to name brought up to vote type thing.
And what would raise a red flag for you if I'm a candidate for tenure and my portfolio is presented to the committee, and I assume you studied the portfolio, what would cause you to think, we better take another look at this candidate?
The difference between whether the candidate did the work or whether his major professor had done it ahead of him. That was the one that was, it's a biggie. It can be disguised, and sometimes it would be very difficult to decipher that.
Did somebody's teaching record count for much, or was it basically their research program?
Certain individuals, what their appointment was. If they were appointed for research and teaching 50-50, or if they were appointed 60-40, 60 teaching, 40 research, we used that judgment in evaluating too. And when it was appropriate, we made more evaluation to the teaching.
Did the candidate...
The hardest candidates to evaluate were extension.
Really?
How do you evaluate an extension?
Did the candidate appear before the committee?
No.
Or you just worked with the portfolio?
Yep.
Were you ever lobbied by members of departments to please grant tenure to X, Y, or Z?
Yes, I guess I would. I would get telephone calls and say, well, since we submitted this portfolio, I want you to know that he has submitted another paper for publication. And this didn't mean anything to me because we didn't count submitted things that had been submitted, things that had been accepted for publication.
You just worked from
Yeah,
the
but
portfolio.
You'd get calls like this.
How did you handle those calls?
Oh, thanks for the information.
Did you ever get complaints from departments when you would not grant tenure?
Yes. Yes.
Did you ever engage in a reconsideration and award tenure on a second go-round?
I recall having second go-arounds come up, but I'd never recall one that was approved on the second one.
If I'm a candidate for tenure and denied, I'm assuming I have an appeal process.
Yes.
And where would that go? To the dean of the graduate school?
It goes through your departmental chair, your college dean, back to the dean of the graduate school. That's the way it was at the time I was serving.
And when were you on the divisional committee?
Probably I don't have dates on that.
Let's see. So I was asking you about your time of service, and you thought the 1980s, and then again in the 1990s.
Yes.
I also see from your CV that you were on the Graduate School Research Committee. What is that and what was that like?
Well, I don't know whether it still exists or not, but it used to be monies from WAF, from the patents and royalties,
uh-huh,
that went into the WAF Foundation. Some of that money was given back to the graduate school for distribution to researchers.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to, as a member of that committee, along with the dean of the graduate school, we would evaluate applications and whether they were deserving of funding to receive some of that money.
So you were evaluating proposals not just from CALS, but from other departments,
right,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been interesting.
Yes, you learned a lot of things that you didn't know much about. Again, you'd evaluate the quality of the proposal, whether they had sufficient controls, whether they had sufficient approach to statistical analysis, or whether the equipment they were using gave state-of-the-art results.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting, very grueling sessions because we had these proposals in advance that we would review in our office on the night before, the days before. Then we would come meet as a group and make a decision and vote on it. Sometimes we would get the rather heated arguments amongst ourselves. And in this case, you would begin to see priorities of disciplines influencing results, which always bothered me. This is a case that I often felt the College of Ag candidates got lower priority than somebody from the medical school or maybe LNS zoology or somebody.
Really? And why do you think that was?
It seems like the majority of the... I shouldn't say that. I think each college had a member on the committee. I was going to say it seemed like we had more members on other areas than we did in agriculture. But, I probably was the only one in agriculture.
Really? For cows?
Yeah.
Because cows is...
No, this was a divisional committee. So
yeah.
I would be the only cows member on that committee.
That's interesting. I thought cows was the second biggest department behind college behind LMS.
But they would just give, one member on the committee for college.
Well, between the divisional committee and the research committee, you're meeting a lot of faculty and a lot of administrative personnel, too, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Which was helpful to you, I assume.
Yeah. Again, I'm having trouble with names. The dean of the graduate school.
Robert Bach?
Yes. Don't you get that? He stands in my mind as one of the most brilliant individuals I ever met.
Really?
And he unfortunate death. Did you hear about his death?
I haven't.
He died in his home pond. Got tangled up in the weeds of his pond in his yard.
Really? He was just wading in it?
Yeah, somebody was trying to get rid of the weeds.
No, I didn't know that.
He knew, to me, every research faculty in the university. And he knew what they had for equipment. If somebody brought one of these proposals in and wanted money to buy a certain microscope, he would say, I recommend we don't approve this, because he can go downstairs to so-and-so's lab because they got one. He can use theirs. That's where it became apparent to me the graduate school owns everything. He was the one that made that very apparent.
Mm-hmm.
He was brilliant, though. How he could know all this in this university, I'll never know.
You liked working with him, I take it.
Yes, because I respected the ability. He seemed to be right, Just couldn't see where he was.
Was he a scientist himself?
He was sort of like my dad. You don't get a new one if you can fix the old one or find another one that's not being used.
Was he a scientist himself?
Yes. Yes.
You were on a lot of committees. You were on the Academic Planning Council under Roger Wise.
Yeah.
Were you the chair of that, or was the dean the chair?
Dean was chair.
And what were the issues that you had to deal with there?
What departments were going to be offering what, and who's going to get, whether it would be a course in biology taught in zoology, or was a course in the College of Agriculture be given biology credit or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
It was, in a way, they were important issues, but not world-shattering decisions.
Mm-hmm. So, again, you probably got...
It involved people wanting to teach new courses, or departments want to add a new course. Hire a faculty member to teach a new course.
Was that a monthly meeting or a weekly meeting?
I think it was monthly.
Okay. So, again, you got to spend a fair amount of time with the dean.
Yes.
And you were telling me yesterday about working with Irv Shane. We were talking yesterday about the University Academic Planning Council when Chancellor Shane was here, and he often had you take over that committee.
Yeah, this was the rare that he often that I would do this, but it was an interesting committee because, again, you dealt with the key individuals around the university community. Again, it was sort of decision-making as to what college would be given the responsibility for doing what. And that's where and I was involved mostly with the academic planning. We even, I don't know, I think another committee I was involved with that we brought up on the academic planning was involved the second committee, the Registration Records Committee. And you know, you can't believe the transition I lived through from registration, from walking around with just a slip of paper to IBM cards to, and
so you were in the transition from the lines at the Red Gym to computerization.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy that?
Well, I introduced a method that I got from the military, basically. Of what's today online registration, basically. And I had an example that was being developed at the University of Michigan that I played to the committee, tape of how you register, potentially could register. And everybody kind of laughed at it, just overlooked it.
They laughed at it?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Is this a case of he who laughs last?
30 years later is what we're doing.
Bernie, how did you get on all these important committees?
You know, I don't know. I think if you show up and do a good job, somebody recognizes it and wants you on that committee again. Picks you out. I guess.
Were you glad to serve on these committees?
You know, I guess to be honest, no. I would prefer to spend time doing my research.
Uh-huh. Were you required, if you were asked to be on divisional committee, for instance, were you basically required to accept?
No, I don't think so. I think it would have been a strike against your worthiness if you fail to participate, fail to do it. You could have said no to a lot of these. Or you could have said, absolutely no, I got too many family matters and so forth. But I don't think it would do your... It would hurt you, your credentials as a professor.
On campus, but
yeah.
Not nationally.
Yeah, right, on campus.
Bernie, you've gotten lots of recognition, honor societies, and you're in professional societies. If you would just talk about the most significant ones in that section.
Probably the most significant one is Poultry Science Association. I was a member of this association since I was a graduate student. And I went up through, probably attended most every meeting except maybe my wife was pregnant, giving birth or something, and I missed one. But otherwise, I attended every meeting. and was named to all the minor committees on the way up through, and became director, vice president, president, past president. So it took years and years and years.
You were president of the CSA.
Right. And so I made a major contribution there in the years. And
do you still go to those meetings?
I do frequently. This year's in San Diego. I just didn't feel I had the money for transportation. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed seeing, I would like to see some of my old friends there. So this was a biggie. You know, we had mid-year meetings that I had to attend, usually in Orlando or somewhere. And I devoted a lot of time to it. Even in the, before I became president, in just the minor committees, given they have a lot of financial awards for excellence in teaching, and I'd be on all these subcommittees they have to evaluate. So that was a lot of time devoted to both sides. So that was a biggie. Long Range Planning Committee. That was a college committee. That would have been under Weiss. He had this Long Range Planning Committee. And, you know, we didn't do much on that. They brought in a professional individual, to sort of a planner. I remember putting post-its on the wall and jockeying them around. And when we got done, he just sort of summarized what was on the posters, and nothing happened. Executive committee. Oh, that's the other thing about poultry science. I became a fellow. And that's a real honor.
Yeah.
Is they may select one or two individuals a year to make them a fellow.
And that, I assume, is based on your research?
No,
primarily?
You're probably based on your contribution to the Society of Poultry Science.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you go through all the channels I went through, that's just sort of a thank you at the end.
Well, I think it's more than that.
Yes,
it's an honor to be a fellow of a...
Yeah, I was at the Endocrine Society. You know, I attended their annual meetings and so forth when I was doing a lot of endocrine work. But other than giving papers, I wasn't a major contributor. Mm. The other thing that goes along with these is reviewing manuscripts. If you're involved with, like, the reproductive physiology, I was a major reviewer. One of the associate editors of the Journal of Reproductive Biology.
Uh-huh.
So you've got a lot of manuscripts to review.
And I suppose that that would be interesting.
It would be interesting, but it was very time-consuming, too. I spent more evenings at home at midnight reviewing a manuscript. Usually they had deadlines on them.
Uh-huh.
They'd want the reviewer's opinion within 10 days or something like this. And it was very... It fit in amongst other things you had and you didn't plan to do.
Uh-huh.
But all of them involved that. Poultry science, endocrine science society, reproductive physiology, Alpha Theta. I was a member here, but never participated very much. It was something that I think they bestowed an honor to me to become a member of the Alpha Theta. And I would do little contributions. And the thing in my life that I don't think it fits into this very well is I contributed the most time to was the U.S. Army. This was
you were with the Army every summer as a member of the reserve?
For 33 years.
And what you were commanding officer at McCoy, you said yesterday?
Yeah, one summer I was. We trained the medics. And I was the head of the training unit. They called it the main medical training unit is in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And we had what they called little Brooks at Fort McCoy.
Oh.
So they got shot of medics and we trained. So they brought the medics in all over the country, to young men and women, to train. And I had to put together the cadre to train them.
Was it difficult to get the time from the university to do that, or were you not on the payroll in the summer?
I was on the payroll. But I would use my vacation time to do that. Uh-huh. I would plan ahead and know that I was going to do it. And there was one summer I went off the payroll because they asked me to extend my stay to 6 weeks. I remember being in Albuquerque. For some reason, some teacher, or I guess he was a colonel actually, got ill and couldn't be there. And in an emergency, they knew I could do it and asked me to continue it or something. And I got permission off the payroll for 4 weeks to stay. My biggest command was the Medical Intelligence Unit in Chicago. And this was very, very critical to the Army, I believe. And I, you know, amongst my military friends, I'm the only full colonel. So I outranked everybody that essentially I've ever been deeply involved with in the Army. And I had this command in Chicago. It was a real honor to be a, what they call an 06.
And what were you charged with doing? What does medical intelligence mean?
To alert the military personnel, Army, Navy, and Air Force, of environmental dangers that infected them medically.
I see.
Something I was just looking at the other day. This little book, Snakes of the World.
Oh, yeah.
Snake venoms, if you get bit. What you're supposed to, this was a pocket manual for every military command. So know what to do with it. Then my big thing in medical intelligence, I was also had an assignment at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and I worked with anthrax while I was there. And some of the things in my life, that, again, my nine lives.
Yes, indeed.
And I got in big trouble there because my wife says I'm an workaholic. I stayed late. You were supposed to leave the facility and lock it up at 4:30. I didn't notice what time it was. I was just working in lab. And I went out at 5 o'clock and the alarms rang and the police swarmed on me. And my boss at the time, he was playing golf, so he had to come to the golf course and justify that I could be in big trouble. And then during the Kuwait crisis, I had the command in Chicago. I got orders to report to Fort Detrick, Walter Reed, and within 10 days. And that time, things cooled off in Kuwait, and they canceled my orders.
Bernie, what was it about being in the military that you liked so much?
It was decision making. the decision was made and followed up. This is something that bothered me in university committee meetings, that we spent too much time just sort of talking without getting to the point where a decision could be made out of the conversation. Sometimes it bothered me, the military. My last command, like in Chicago, I had to meet with the general once a week. And that was hard to teach here from Tuesday afternoon and get to Chicago by 7 o'clock. And I had to give my report from my section every week. And you were allowed 5 minutes. And you shut you off. That's enough if your 5 minutes is up. So I learned how to digest things down into very, very brief, concise points of concern. And I like this. I like this in other people. You know, that you don't... Well, I don't like the idea that, well, we'll make a decision in a week or two. Or maybe I'll know tomorrow. You know, probably you're going to know right now what you're going to know tomorrow. And I like this about the military.
Uh-huh. Are you active at all anymore in the military?
No. Unfortunately, some of us that knew each other here in Madison got together this summer, terribly disappointed, and I guess I happened to be the commanding individual there, but a lot of them had gone up almost to colonel. I'm so sad that the health is not good. I inquired about other people, and they were in assisted living, and they were younger than I. I was probably the oldest individual in amongst the group. So it makes you count your blessings.
Yeah.
Some of it dates back to the military. You know, when I was 65 years old, I still had to do a 4-mile run to stay qualified for the year.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we were talking earlier about your hardy constitution.
I remember running, it must have been 100 degrees in southern Indiana one time doing a 4-mile run. And I was quite old.
Did you, could you trot or did you have to run?
You were at a time limit. If you didn't do it in a certain length of time, you had a chance to redo it. They gave you they were quite generous about retakes. But most everybody tried to get it the first time so they wouldn't have to
do it again.
And I shouldn't be analyzing, but the military accommodated my profession. You know, I remember giving a paper at Purdue, and I was doing summer camp in the arms pits of the Army in southern Indiana called Fort Atterbury. At the time, I was a commander for the week I was there because I was a ranking person, I discovered. Because I needed a water trailer because it was so hot. We were short of water. And the guy that was in charge of it said, well, you can't have it. And I finally says, I'm in command here this week. We do have it. But then they flew me from Camp Atterbury to Purdue to give a paper. Yeah.
But that was a reflection, don't you think, of their assessment of your value?
I don't know, but I thought it was nice that I was able to get up to give my paper. I remember arriving in the helicopter in military uniform and finding the nearest restroom to go get dressed to go give a paper.
Bernie, Was it an issue here at the university or with your colleagues that you were in the military? Because I would guess that there are not many faculty who held positions like you did in the reserves.
It was a more of an issue then than it would be today. We were in this still post-Vietnam era.
Uh-huh.
And we had faculty members in the department was not fully approving of it. You know, we like on a Tuesday night to have they want to do something, and then I'll say, well, I suppose you can't, you've got army. You know, there'd be little comments like this. But I tried to keep it rather private, basically, not involve the department, the university.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, I got telephone calls that bothered me. And we had a secretary here in the office at the time, I think, got very concerned that I got military calls.
Oh, I see. We often worry about all the wrong things, don't we?
Yeah. But, you know, I tried to be careful about it. Mm-hmm. And just...
Bernie, as we move toward the end of the interview, I want to ask you, from where you sit now, how you assess the university and your time at the university, what you've liked, not liked, what has worked well, and what you see coming in the future for both the university and higher education.
Yes, well, thanks for the opportunity. I truly believe it's one of the greatest universities in the world. And I definitely have not been associated with very many, but of those that I've had the opportunity to, in some cases at, in other parts of my interviews here, I have gone to other universities and evaluated their programs, which I probably should have mentioned earlier. And in going to other universities and evaluating programs, I find this University of Wisconsin stands out as being really unique in its value in higher education. And in the future, I cannot help but believe that under the current system of progression in administration, that it will definitely continue to be a great university.
It will not?
It will, but will continue.
It will continue.
It's a university that's driven by its faculty. The faculty drive the university, and it goes back to generation after generation, hiring talented and conscientious faculty, and they making decisions in the prior, you know, upper administration where the university will move forward. And we may lack a little bit of link in the university with a political system of the state. Perhaps there is not always good relationships with a state government with the university. Perhaps there is a deficiency in the university personnel not making themselves available enough to assist the state in their administrative policies and decisions. Is there anything else I need to follow?
My only other question to you, Bernie, is as you look at American culture, are you at all concerned or optimistic about the value that we'll place on educating our populace, particularly at the collegiate and graduate level?
Yeah, I really think that we have to make an effort to make education, higher education, available to as many as possible. And I think this is the real progress in our society. It's a time of life of students where they can evaluate and come to realize the assets of diversity, and they have to ingrain this as part of their thinking and their way of life. The diversity and what people do for make a living and what their priorities are in life and so forth. We have to, I think, be better listeners and be more ready to say thank you for things that people do for us. And this includes the appreciation the students have for their faculty and perhaps their grants and so forth to continue their education. They have to have this as a priority in a young environment.
Wonderful. So this now concludes the interview with Professor Wentworth. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have been a real gift to the university.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you.